This is Tribeca Talks, our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm Leah Sarbib. This conversation is from our 2019 director series. Martin Scorsese is, for many, the quintessential New York director. Not only has he won an Academy Award, but with 9 directing nominations, he's the most nominated living director in Oscars history. His collaboration with Robert De Niro is legendary. They've worked together on 9 films. In this conversation, they played clips from some of those films and from Scorsese's other seminal movies. We've included the audio from those clips in this podcast. Here's the clip from Mean Streets to start it off.
You don't know what happened to me. I'm so depressed about other things. I can't worry about payments. You know what I mean? I come home last Tuesday. I have my money, cash. You know? Blah, blah, bing, bing. I come home. I ran into Jimmy Sparks. I owe Jimmy Sparks $700, like, for 4 months. I got to pay the guy. Lives in my building. Hangs out across the street. I got to pay the guy, right?
Yeah.
So what happened? I had to give some to my mother, and then I wound up with 25 at the end of the week. And then what happened today, you ain't gonna believe, because it's just incredible. I can't believe it myself.
What?
I was in a game. I had like $600-$700, right?
You gotta be kidding.
Yeah, Hester Street. You know Joey Clams?
Yeah.
Joey Scala, yeah.
I know him too, yeah.
Yeah, Joey Scala's Joey Clams.
Right.
Right.
They're the same person.
Yeah.
Hey.
Hey. So I was in there playing bankers and brokers. All of a sudden, I'm ahead like $600-$700. I'm really winning. All of a sudden, some kid walks in, and the kid yells that the bulls are coming, right? Yells the cops are coming. Everybody runs away. I grab all the money. I go in. It's an excuse, like, to get away.
Right.
You know, and I give everybody the money back later. And that way I get out. I don't have to get into the game and get a losing streak and all that. What happens? I come out of the yard. I don't know this building. Meek, I don't know nothing. Couldn't get out. It was like a box, being like this. So I got to go back in. Not only do I go back in, but this kid says it's a false alarm. Imagine that. I wanted to kill this fucking kid. I mean, I was so crazy. I wanted to kill this kid. Meanwhile, I got to get back in the game. Bing, bing, bing. I lose $400.
This scene has had an evolution in the editing of the film, too, when I was cutting it. This, in a way, and I know, Bob, you've done Bang the Drum Slowly. You've been in Brian's films. But when this was released, this scene was the one, I think, that grounded our careers in a way. I think there was something that just shot out from the screen. And it was your idea to do it because you felt that the character, you said to me in rehearsal that Charlie, played by Harvey Keitel, would have to, he goes through so much defending him and helping for whatever reasons, and very complicated, but he does. And Bob said that you had to show how Harvey is taken in by Johnny. And so you came up with an improv, and I wrote down those notes in a little book. And it wasn't in the script, so we went to the last day of shooting. It was 24 days or 25 days. And then I begged John Taplin, who was our producer, to give us another 2 hours to shoot this. And I forgot the book.
Wow.
He had to remember everything from 4 weeks earlier.
Yeah, no, I remember we shot that in L.A.
Yeah.
I think we shot 2 weeks in New York and 3 in L.A.
Yeah.
And we had improvised. I had worked on this with Marty. We worked on it at the old Gramercy Park Hotel. And then I remember that I had all these, and I have those somewhere, those notes. I know they're, but I was worried about hitting the points, even though you improvise it, you have to make sure you get point A, B, C, D, da, 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 da. And so that was my big concern before we shot the scene, actually did the scene.
And this thing about this scene is very important because when I made this movie, it was a real dream, and I came out of my whole who I was, who I am, and that sort of thing, out of my own heart, in a way, and soul. And I never even thought the picture would be released, quite honestly. And I thought when this scene was done that if anybody ever wanted to know what it was like living in that world at that time, it's like a time capsule. They just play this one scene even to get a sense of the subculture of the Italian-American and Sicilians, Neapolitans in that area, downtown, not necessarily the Bronx or the West Side, but the East Side. And so the point being that it was a story. It's a strange thing with this film because some people were offended by it. A lot of people that are some of the characters are based upon were offended. But understandably, but you know, the atmosphere of the place and all that. I was with Robert Urecola a few weeks ago, and he's he was the guy who actually put us together.
Yeah,
he was my friend.
Yeah.
You know.
How is he?
He's okay. He's okay. Oh, he's been. People get sick now. You know, he's fine. He's fine. And Joe was with him.
Yeah.
And at one point, we were having a little something to eat. At one point, I haven't seen him like in 2 years. And at one point, he said he lives in Florida now. At one point, he says, "You know, I've been looking at these films and I'm reading these books and things." He said about that wonderful place, that great place where everybody was so great and people had wonderful families and things were terrific. This paradise. Where was that? He said, "Are they talking about where?" I said, "No, can't be talking about where we were." He said, "Yes, I believe they are." And it wasn't a paradise. Simply not. It just simply one has to take in the negative things of what was going on. It was a world that you know has been, I think, romanticized since then, and so. It's become something that, even in the new film, our new film, we still deal with the, how should I put it, the nature of it, the essence of who the people are. Not necessarily the trappings around them, but who the people are.
Yeah, and The Irishman. Well, it's just the same thing. What we had, The Irishman was... the book was terrific, I thought, and then I said, "Marty, read this, see what you think." And we said, "Let's go." We were about to do something else, and then we went into The Irishman. It was just a whole other something that would be right.
Well, it was profoundly. I think you really felt the heart of this character and this situation, and it's a universal
exactly.
story. It really happens to be set in that world. And one has to understand, too, that, yes, the families, my parents were great. You know, I lived in 253 Elizabeth Street, third floor front. And I saw everything because of asthma and I couldn't run around and stuff. So I would see everything from the an overhead shot from the third floor looking down. Now, they're in my movies and some critics say, "Oh, he's always doing God's point of view." No, actually, it's... I got to tell you, it looks great from up there, you know? And so, and I was, we grew up in a world, I was there in 1949, 1950, 55. On Elizabeth Street, we were bounded on the east by what they called at that time, Devil's Mile, the Bowery. On the west by what they called at that time, Murder Mile, Mulberry Street. So the connotations, those were names given to those places over a period of decades. So they had to have elements of the dark side, and that's where we grew up.
Yeah, I think your father was it. Is this true? I mean, I think I verified it with you. I'm not sure though, but your father actually came up with the word Goodfellas. Was that true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Him and Nick Pileggi were talking.
Yeah, Nick. Yeah, because such a great word as opposed to wise guy, which is legitimate, but Goodfellas is it's much more specific.
Yeah. Well, the thing was about, like, it's in a mumbling kind of coded language, which is, you know, no, he's okay, he's a good fella, he's all right.
Yeah.
He's all right, good fella. That's it. Not this is a good fella. Okay? No, because also Brian De Palma just made a comedy called Wise Guy.
Oh, he did?
Wise Guys, yeah, that killed it. I saw God. So we couldn't use it, but... But in any event, no, we find that we keep going back to that world because I think we're trying to get to what's essential. The microcosm is the macrocosm, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that, I guess for want of a better way of saying it, it was special and specific, unique, we knew what it was.
Yeah. But when you mean knew what it was, you know, basically we were confident in what we were doing. And we believed in it. And if people don't agree with you, they don't agree with you. You know, you want to be liked by everybody, but it ain't going to happen.
No. It's the music. What made you decide to do the music in the film?
The music for me. Again, because of my physical issues with asthma and not doing any sports and being taken to movie theater and then finding my way in the church in St. Patrick's, you know, the two refuges for me. I was so immersed in American cinema, movies and cinema, entertainment, serious films, not serious, Italian films, neorealist, and other foreign films coming in, Bergman, that sort of thing. And so for me, the only, because I didn't come from a reading culture. They had no books in the apartment. They didn't read. So for me, it was all visual and storytelling, like you tell the story here in this scene, or my mother telling a story, my father telling a story, like street people on the street corner telling a story. You know, this is the first theater in a way. And so it was really that. And as much as I loved Bernard Herrmann and Elmer Bernstein and Miklos Rozsa and Dmitri Tiomkin and all these great composers, Georges Delarue, all the French, and Maurice Jarre, as much as I loved all that music, I knew I could not, that wasn't my world. I could not use that. The world I came from was scored by the music I heard in my apartment and in the street through other people's windows that are open in the summer. Because there were no air conditioning, all the windows were open, and so the music was a combination of, you know, a big band jazz and opera, and then of course rhythm and blues, and then rock and roll. And for me, the first music I heard was this. My father liked guitars, so it was Django Reinhardt in the Hot Club of France, and so that for me it created images in my head when I was about 4 years old or 5 years old that were abstract, and that has always been the. That's always been the way I start designing a picture. Somehow music, I play certain kinds of music and some you just let it go. You just let it go and you have to be alone for that. You gotta be like in some room somewhere for a few days, that sort of thing. But the music is what scored our lives. And more than nostalgia, Bob, you know what I'm saying? Whether it was Mascagni or whether it was, Roy Orbison or The Drifters. You know?
Yep. That was it.
What it is, it's like, you know, yes, I got to work with Bernard Herrmann, I got to work with Elmer Bernstein, but that's when I tried to make movies.
Should we go to the last waltz?
Please.
Okay.
This is a clip, two clips are coming up, and one is music and one is, you'll see.
She stands on the banks of the mighty Mississippi, alone in the pale moonlight, waiting for a man. A riverboat gambler said that he'd return tonight.
They used to waltz on the bank of mighty Mississippi, loving the whole night through, till the riverboat gambler went off to make a killing and bring it on back to you.
Gallant Marcel Cerdan. After the tragic plane crash that took Cerdan's life, Laurent Dautil vowed to bring the title back to France. And tonight, he only has to last his 15th round to be crowned the new middleweight champion. Lamotte is taking terrible punishment on the ropes as Dautil bangs him with left and right to the head. Another left, another right to the jaw. And Lamotte turns around. He's been playing possum. He's got Dautil hurt. He gets the right hand of the body. So left to the jaw. Another left and a right to the head. Dautil is flailing around the ring. The tide has turned, no question about it. And he wobbles into the rope and goes down. field is down, and the referee, Lou Hamblin, comes over and starts the count. He's trying to get up. 6, 7. He'll never make it. 9, 10. It is all over. He is knocked out. And Jake LaMotta, with 13 seconds left to go in the final round, has made one of the most remarkable comebacks in all boxing history.
Ooh. Yeah. Well, yeah, there it is.
So you picked those two pieces.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that I learned, again, when we talked about music and the music conjuring up images in my head in this, you know, little apartment on Elizabeth Street in the tenements, that's the most extraordinary feeling of freedom, the imagination and the frisson, that music that you respond to, all kinds of music. Here you have Evangeline, the white soul of Hank Williams, in a sense, you know, Emmylou Harris there in the band. And being in America is amazing because you get the influence of all these kinds of music, you know, especially in the East Coast here, but and at that time. But the thing about it was that I imagine images in my head, and so I stepped into a kind of world. We're doing, not necessarily Taxi Driver, the end of Taxi Driver, I'd say the shootout. But by the time I did this Last Waltz thing, Evangeline, The Wait, and The Last Waltz itself, theme music, were done and designed on paper to the music, shot by shot. All the drawings do exist, they're there. And it wasn't a situation where you have 7 cameras and you select later. It was a matter of, the first shot was a tracking shot this way, which ends on Emmylou, then comes around this way, then you cut, and it's a tracking shot from the rear, but it has to be straight. It can't be curved in any way. And basically, the bars of music.
Because, not curved, because?
Well, it has a direct feeling. There's something about the way I imagined it when I heard the music. I said, what if we're just sliding along these guys, not in like this, but just sliding with the music, sliding with those guitars, you know, and her voice, like an angel, you know, and it takes you out of it, and now you start soaring away. And so there maybe have been like 6 shots in the whole scene. And so when the time came to do Raging Bull, and I had resisted for a while because for a few years, actually, because I didn't understand boxing, really, and it's a long story, but bottom line, because I didn't have any experience of sports. In fact, if I saw anybody run, you know what I mean? I thought, oh, I can't do that, and if there's a ball involved, forget it.
Well, you would tell me, go rehearse, go practice boxing, do whatever, and then I'll come watch it and take video, da-da-da.
Yeah, you see, that. Thank God there was video at the time, because by the time I realized I could do the movie and I got into what your head was saying about that character, and the movie's really the character, it's not necessarily the boxing scenes. And so this character was so extraordinary that I felt that the boxing scenes had to be special, but I didn't know how. And one day it was on 14th Street, there was the gym.
Yeah, yeah. 14th Street gym.
Right next to Lou Chow's, the old Lou Chow's and the Academy of Music. And you got in the ring, I think it was with Jimmy Nickerson?
Could be, yeah.
Or Jake, I think it was Jimmy.
Jimmy or Jake, yeah.
And they videoed the thing, right?
Yeah.
This is 78. So, I mean, video at that time was black and white, you know, one angle. And I got there and I'd gone through some... I was just recuperating from a long period of kind of a desperate search as to what kind of film to make and what was going to happen in my life. And I sat down, you said, okay, we're going to go through this. And you've been working on this for a year more,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, a while, yeah.
And you went through all 9 fights.
Jesus.
Yeah,
I
know. And I, exactly my reaction, I sat there and I suddenly realized this is overwhelming. I said, I just can't shoot this. I have to design it all. Well, we design it based on their choreography, but still, I said, this has to be, you know, the Wild Bunch. There's got to be Peckinpah. This can't be in the terms of the choreography of the camera and the physical choreography, combining Jimmy, Jake, you and me, and Mike Chapman on camera. And I think our Marquette, I think, who was the camera operator.
Yeah.
Those days, we didn't have any video assist. So your operator was the guy, you see, letting you know if you got it or not. But I realized that we, and I just froze. And I remember you came out and you looked at me and you came down and you said, "Are you okay?" I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm killing myself in there. Are you paying attention?" I said, "Yeah. I know, I got it. You didn't know what was going on in my head. I said, "Oh my God, this is going to be..." Because what happened, once I finally designed according to your choreography, they planned 5 weeks of shooting, but we went 11.
Yeah.
On the boxing scenes. And so what I did was take the cue. Was that the natural progression was how the music moved me, and how if you had four lefts and one right, that was two bars of music. And so what I did in Last Waltz was applied to the boxing scenes, and it became very arduous to do. You know, sometimes when you get like what, one setup a day.
Did we use Garrett Graham and the Steadicam?
We tried to use Garrett, but the new thing was the Steadicam at that time. This is a good example. The one fight that I didn't design was your championship fight, which because the character wanted that championship, and I figured, okay, let's go through round two, round three. Then at one point, Marcel Cerdan hurt his arm. He said, "I can't fight anymore." Okay, he wins. He gets, okay, big deal. We know that. Okay. I said, so, you know, let's use this new device, the Steadicam. And the day we shot it, I didn't understand about the Steadicam at that point. I felt it when I saw the rushes that it was indefinite. I was not criticizing the technique. I didn't know how to use it. It was floating. And this is Sean. This is like headlines and tabloids. This is something that's like Ouija, you know?
Yeah.
It has to be strong and it has to have conviction. And you have to know where to put the lens so the audience could see what you think they should see. You have to direct it. And I realized I couldn't get away with it. I have to direct it. And Garrett said, "You didn't give it a chance." He told me, "You didn't give the camera a chance." I said, "No, I have to do the work." So we went and we reshot it. And it worked out much better. And then Garrett was redeemed in a way, because we did that, I think, a very beautiful shot that starts in the beginning of the scene, that starts in the dressing room. You say, I'm the boss. And you go all the way through, and it goes down the aisle, and all the 1,000 extras, remember? And get in the ring. That was a Steadicam shot. That's using it the right way, you see. But the character was the thing, Jake. That was the character that it became, not the real Jake.
Yeah.
But, you know, do you remember that meeting in the Galleria?
Oh, with
when
her,
two with, guys came up and tried to talk us out of it.
Who? Oh, I forgot that.
It was like Irwin Winkler, who was one of the producers, Charter Winkler, you know. And the script had been done, and then we rewrote it, Paul's script. He took me to an island. He enjoyed the island. I stayed inside, you know. It was 2.5 weeks we were there with this person who was typing it out. We rewrote the whole thing. And got back. Irwin loved it. The studio kind of liked it. He said they liked it.
Yeah.
I said, okay. We were like idiots at the time, saying, "Oh, we're going to get the film made." No, it wasn't that simple. And at the same time, Heaven's Gate was being made at the same studio.
Yeah.
Apocalypse had just been made. Apocalypse Now was all United Artists, and they were great. Eric Pleskow and Arthur Krim. So what happened was that I had an apartment on 57th Street, and we were there discussing the script or whatever. Irwin said, "You know, the couple of the guys from the studio were here, and they just like to come by, say hello." I said, "Why? What do they want?" He said, "No, they just want to say hello. We're going to check in. You know, you want to make the film a black and white now, and they, you know, they want to talk, the black and white thing. All right. Okay, so we're there, and two guys came up. Actually, two very good guys. I like them.
Who was it?
David Field.
Yeah.
And the guy who wrote Final Cut, Stephen Bach.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And the story is in the Final Cut book, actually, Stephen Bach's book. And they were questioning us about the film, and they were sent there, I guess, by the front office. And we were just behaving as if, like, we're answering questions, and I answered the questions the best I could about the black and white. And then at one point, one of the guys said, "Why do you want to make a film about this guy? This guy is a cockroach." And I mean, it's actually a valid question, because it's about entertainment also, you see. In fact, the opening scene is that's entertainment, he says. And so your reaction was articulate and it was grand in a sense. You said, no, he's not. That froze them. I'm not kidding. It was like, no, that was like, and we said, yeah, everything went, the meeting went on nice and nice. And they all left and we were making the film. I don't know what happened. A year or so later, Irwin, in his new book, Irwin Winkler's book, he tells this story. They were on their way up to cancel the film.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't let us know.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so was, you know, here's this film that in terms of that character and dealing with his self-destructive nature, his self-hatred, and then his sense of, by the end, we hoped that he became resigned to himself and a little less hard on the people around him and himself, yeah. You know?
You know, I you remember when we spoke about me, you, and Marduk, about Marduk was the original writer
Marduk Martin.
And Marduk and I would go and do research and meet Jake's wife and other people involved in the story. And then I had a thought about doing it as a play, doing like a one-man show or something, and then shooting in the day and doing the play at night. And we actually talked to the studio about that, and they listened naturally. And I think they would have gone along with it if it could have been possible. But I realized it was too crazy.
No, we were crazy.
Yeah. Crazy.
Well, we're young. I mean, 32 or 33 or something that. You know, hey, we could do it.
But it was... That idea lasted for a minute.
We tried. Remember that? I think there was a play. Marduk wrote a version of the play.
He might have, He might have gone,
You know, but that's a thing, too, where if you're that age and you could, there's that will, the energy of going from the movie set to the stage, then back, you feed off that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought I could do it. But it was just the logistics of the weight, too, and then back and all that. Do I wear a fat suit? I remember I was thinking, I said, oh, God, this is so complicated. And we would talk. It was tough enough to get the script right, which we finally did down at the island. And though in theory it seemed like would have been an interesting thing to do.
Yeah.
Whether it could have been really done is another story.
But on the island, it became, I don't know. We just got into it, and it became had a life of its own then. It was like an organism just took off. I remember checking with Michael Powell, who was alive at the time, and he was a friend of ours, and is a great filmmaker, known for his best-known film is The Red Shoes, of all things. That's an example. The Red Shoes ballet sequence, which is 25 minutes in the middle of the film, 1950, before American in Paris, before all this other stuff, is an example of... dance as perceived in the dancer's mind. And very many, I should say, an avant-garde film, really. Many dance aficionados and people who are really feel that sequence, it's not right for dancing. In other words, you don't see the full figure of the person. I said, well, it's not about the dance. If you want that, see another kind of film. This is about what she's going through in her life at that point on and acted out and expressed through these movements. It seemed like movements because the avant-garde nature of the cutting and the shooting and the use of color takes off. And so that played, in a way, into the music I did with Last Waltz and later on, and of course in the boxing scenes, you know. In fact, one more quick thing. It was at that time, we were meeting a lot of these guys who were like in P.J. Clark's, and Jake LaMotta was sitting there, right? And one of the guys was Norman Mailer, remember?
Oh, I forgot,
Yeah. He'd come by and they'd say, hey, Jake this and Jake that. And there's Norman, another group I did not belong in. So, you know, and you think you do, and then all of a sudden, no, let me get the hell out of here. before I make a worse fool of myself. And so at one point later on when I decided, before we went to the island, I told him, I saw him somewhere, and I said, Jake LaMotta film's coming along, I'm not going to do any of the fights. And he looked at me and said, oh, that's the whole point. He's a great fighter. You have to put the fights in. I said, oh, God, and that was before you showed me. And so I put the fights in. We did the whole thing. 2 years later, I meet him somewhere at an event. And as he was leaving, I said, hey, Norman, I said, you know, put the fights in thanks to you. He goes, yeah, it's the only thing I didn't like in the picture. Because you don't see the fight. You see what he sees. You experience what he experiences. You hear what he hears. You don't see how the genius of the moves. You see, that's the thing. I just didn't go for it. What do you got?
Go to casino?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Oh, no, it's scary. It's King of Comedy.
King of Comedy. Sorry, I had it wrong on my list.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Jerry Langford, please.
Your name, please?
Pumpkin. Rupert Pumpkin.
Rupert.
Pumpkin, P-U-P-K-I-N. People often misspell it and mispronounce it.
There's a man here by the name of Rupert Pumpkin who wants to see Mr. Langford. I'm sorry, Mr. Pumpkin, but Mr. Langford's secretary has no record of your appointment.
Pardon me?
We have no record of your appointment.
Oh, well, technically speaking, I don't have an official appointment with Jerry, but he did ask me to call him personally, and I was in the neighborhood. I thought I'd just stop up. I was having trouble calling for some reason. The line seemed to be busy, and...
He has no appointment. Mr. Langford's secretary wants to know what this is in reference to.
Oh, sure.
Mr. Gangany, go right.
Hello? Yes, Jerry and I discussed my being on the show last night. He told me to call. Yes. No, sure. I'm supposed to wait.
Reception. No, you got an hour or so before they come in.
Yeah.
No, he hasn't come back from the meeting yet. Mr. Pipkin?
Pumpkin.
Oh, sorry. I'm Kathy Lowe. Can I help you?
Hello. You are?
I'm Bert Thomas's assistant. He's our executive producer.
Oh, I'm sorry. You see, I've already spoken to Jerry directly about my being on the show, and he told me to get in touch with him personally. I'm here to follow up on that.
You are. What is it exactly that you do?
I stand-up comic.
Oh. Where are you working now?
Well, right now, I'm just working on new material.
Oh. Well, I'll tell you what. As soon as you do start working again... Why don't you give us a call and we'll send someone down to check out your act, all right? Thanks so much for stopping.
Jerry and I went over all this last night.
Does Jerry know your work?
Yes. I don't think he does.
You have a tape or something I could listen to?
A tape? Oh, naturally. Whatever you'd like.
Well, thank
sure.
you. Why don't you drop me
no
a tape, all right?
I will. I can see where Jerry would need that.
Yes.
Of course. Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you, too.
Nice meeting you. This is really what's right. This is great. This is... See you again. Nice.
Well, the woman, the receptionist, is Irwin Winkler's wife.
Margot,
who was great.
I mean, this is, again, one of the ones you wanted me to make.
I dragged him into it.
Yeah. Well, you gave me the script, I think right at the time of Taxi Driver, I think, or a little after.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but we met Paul Zimmerman in Cannes,
yeah.
I think. He gave us the script, or gave me the script.
You the script, yeah.
And I liked it a lot. And then there was a period, I don't know how...
Mike Cimino, right?
Milos. With Milos. And somehow he got involved, but I wanted you to do it, but you couldn't do it or something, so I was just saying, okay, let me see with Milos, and he had another writer do a version... That I didn't feel was as good as Paul's, so I met Milos in an Indian restaurant on Second Avenue, and I said, "Look, I'm going to go back to the original, and I'd like to work with you, of course, but I want to do it with Marty, and I'm going to bring him the original." And then I went back to you, and we talked, and I was trying to convince you to get interested in it, and so that's how it's.
But I think part of it, a lot of it had to do with when I first read it, I felt in Paul Zimmerman's script, it was really good. But ultimately, I felt, well, it's like a one-line gag. I said, the guy wants to get on TV so badly, he kidnaps the host of the television show. I said, and so? And what I missed was celebrity. What I missed and what you saw in it was the yearning, the need of the celebrity to be famous. Famous for what? Not necessarily anything, but famous. Like, and I go back to George Cukor's film with Judy Holliday back in 52, I think it was called It Should Happen to You, where she plays a character named Gladys Glover, who just puts her name on a billboard in Columbus Circle. She becomes famous for nothing. For nothing. It's Jack Lemmon's first film. It's a beautiful film. And so the thing about it, too, that you had started experiencing fame in a different way after Godfather 2, Deer Hunter, and you remember the story that the person, you went to dinner? Remember that you went to dinner, you said, what do you want?
He's saying, I said, somebody, what do you want from me? I said,
well, there's a thing that the guy kept writing to, please come and have dinner with me, please come to my house, please come.
Yeah.
And you did.
Yeah, well, I I dragged Marty along to a couple of places. And
they hated me. Yeah.
And I remember us sitting on this one guy's bed in his bedroom. He lived with his parents. And Marty was sort of there. Yeah, you got me here. And it was funny. I said, just for the experience, let's just see what this is, you know. And he didn't say you got me. He just knew that he was probably thinking. And then we went to another. And then I see these guys around too from time. One works for one of the tabloids.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But now we know them.
Yeah,
we became friends with them. Yeah.
But I said, eventually that's what's going to happen. These same people or the autograph people, they're going to wind up working for the tabloids or whatever. We'll see them around sometime, as we did. And I thought it'd be interesting for us to go through that and use them. And of course, Marty used them in the film.
But the thing was that, you see, you were experiencing this and I was not. So I didn't quite understand. The grabbing, in fact, the movie opens with Jerry in the car and Sandra Bernhardt's hands come up to the window and it holds and it says the king of comedy, our hands are trying to grab Jerry. For what? What do they want? What do they want outside of their own lives and what's happened to our culture, basically? I remember when the film came out, we got killed for the film. Yeah. It was reviled, except, no, okay. Times gave it a good review and there was a good review, I think, in Time magazine. But bottom line is there were these new popular shows like Entertainment Tonight or something. And they came out and they said, it blames the media and that's outrageous. And I think at that point, too, it was like the absolutely perfectly wrong time to release the film. After Raging Bull and after Heaven's Gate and Apocalypse and that sort of thing, they expected, I think, the audience from our collaboration something different. And this was different, but they wanted another way.
Yeah, and I remember you and I, we were sitting when we were rehearsing at the Mayflower. We actually sat and talked about that. What do you think about this thing, what it means, this and that? And I think we said, well, okay, we're not sure about certain things, but we're going to go ahead anyway. You know, it was just like, you have your ups, you have your downs. You think, well, maybe this thing, is it worth it? And I remember we had this sort of mini come to Jesus moment, and then, but we said, let's go on.
Let's do it.
And,
I mean, what happened with me on the picture was that after Raging Bull, I put so much into that film, and I just kind of collapsed in a way. I wound up with walking pneumonia and all kinds of stuff, and I was completely out of it, and I agreed to do this one, because by that point, I began to understand more of what you were going for in it, and the script was really good, and I decided that because of the techniques I used in Raging Bull and Taxi Driver and other pictures, that I was going to pull back and kind of redefine what the narrative through camera is. This film is very reliant on dialogue and on relationships of people in the frame, and I shot it as simply as possible, and I wanted to recreate in my head like a reset button of how to make a movie, or how to tell a story, I should say, not even a movie, tell a story. And it was a great story, you know. But also during it, I began to realize how much of Rupert even of Jerry, to a certain extent, you know. You were ahead of that. You were dealing with it. You were acting it out. I had to sit there and do it, you know. Like suddenly, it was being touched upon. Things were being touched. And I suddenly became very. I found it difficult to get to the set to work because I was embarrassed, I think. Mm. About myself in a way. Jerry sensed that he was, remember?
Yeah.
He was like, oh, God.
Yeah.
And it was painful for me to make. I don't mean
really,
it was a painful experience. It was, a painful experience emotionally and psychologically. But everybody, you guys were behaving well. Everybody was great. It was like I could not get there. And finally, it was 100-day shooting.
Was it really that long? Wow. No, I remember you and I had these long talks at the camper. Jerry be waiting, and I realized Jerry's older than us. He's more, and he's a veteran, and da da da. And I felt, geez, we better.
Yeah.
To myself, I felt that I was not being sensitive enough about his situation. But we just get in these long conversations about what it was. This and that.
I know. And sometimes it wasn't really about the film. A lot of times, it was just. But the thing is that's part of the work, and. It's like a meditation process. I must say, it's like you pull away from everything else and you get focused again. You get focused again. I find that with the, that it's very, it's a very important part of the process. It's better if you kind of figure it into the day in terms of length of time. And with Jerry Lewis, I adore Jerry, but the point was that I never really worked with, a pro on that level.
Yeah, no.
So I usually the films that we made from Mean Streets and Alice's Liberty Moore's Ellen Burstyn, it was a different kind of thing. Christopherson, we were all making it together. It was like low budget stuff, Taxi Driver, other films, New York. But here, and Raging Bull particularly, and my parents were in them, But here I.
Well, your mother was in this. Your mother would call me
Gerald.
She'd call me Rupert. When I was down.
Yeah, she
in the
plays
basement.
The mother, the voice when he was down in her basement. That's my mother torturing Bob. It was the only time I ever saw him really crack up laughing. I said, "What's he doing?" His camera, his back was to the camera. We had a little video at that time, and his shoulders were shaking because the. There was nothing you can get past her. She's not impressed. It's my son's friend. And so whatever he said, she took it on and like, whoa, okay. We couldn't get past this one. But Jerry was the one because he taught me that. I always tell the story in the third night of shooting, I think it was fourth night, where I kept him waiting all night and I couldn't get to him. And finally they said, Jerry would like to talk to you. I said, okay. So I go to his trailer. Oh, he came to my trailer because he was smoking at the time.
Oh, yeah.
His trailer was filled with smoke. And I think it was it here, the Beacon?
We were shooting here. You mean that
the exterior
the
when he gets in the car.
No, it was around here. It was on 79th and Broadway, further up. Yeah.
And so
80th, 79th.
He looked at me and he said, I got to tell you, I'm a total professional. You're paying for my time. All right. I'll be here. When I'm supposed to be here, I'm a total pro. The only thing I ask is if at a certain point in time, like 1, 2 in the morning, you feel that you aren't going to get to me, tell me so I could go home. And I said, oh, it isn't only about us. Well, we were, in a way, it was naive and I guess sociopathological, right? And, huh? And I began to understand about time and age, and the physicality of the shoot, which was a very tough shoot, actually. Yeah. Also, the improvs went on for ages.
Yeah. And some great stuff
that
I wish one day you could put the whole film together with other characters. The Chuck Lowe, who played Maury in Goodfellas.
Yeah.
He had some great stuff in there.
And Diane.
Diane and... I was thinking about the show when we did the fantasy. It was a fantasy where I go on the show with Jerry.
Yeah.
And so you were up in the control booth there watching, and I'm doing the show, getting on. And I had not done much, if any, kind of shows like that, really, to that point. And Jerry
That's
was
right.
like
yeah.
this. It was a whole different professional rhythm that you see in all these talk shows. You just kind of go in, and you're ready. You have to amp it up a notch or two. And Jerry said, listen, and made me aware of that kind of theatricality in a certain way.
Yeah.
You just get pulled into it, into the rhythm. And I remember you came down because you felt he was like, you've got to be down here to be present because Jerry was like doing so much, but you had to like get
hold of it. Well, I wanted him to like direct it, but he became very you know.
Yeah.
He was pretty tough on everybody. Yeah. And yeah, so I said, I better get down there. Because what I wanted was his... concept of what the talk show should be, because he had his own talk show. He did all this. He did everything, you know.
Yeah, it was interesting. Interesting. We had no idea. I had no idea that it was that way until he made me aware of it.
No, it's a special film that I think now is kind of prescient at the time. 10 years later, it was considered in two at that time, there were film magazines that were seriously about film. There still is one, Film Comment. But there was a couple of others, and it was one of the people voted one of the 10 best of the decade, and people had forgotten about it completely. I said, wow, 1990, people were talking about amazing. And people now think it was this, you know, glorious hit, and it was reviled. In L.A., we were replaced immediately by a film called Losing It, you know. And good director too on that, Losing It, I forget. But in any event, it was an extraordinary experience, and it was a resetting of the mind. It was a resetting completely, you know. We think of.
Yeah. So we go to Casino.
Yeah, let's do Casino.
Okay.
Meeting in the middle of the desert always made me nervous. It's a scary place. I knew about the holes in the desert, of course, and everywhere I looked, there could have been a hole. Normally, my prospects of coming back alive from a meeting with Nicky were 99 out of 100. But this time, when I heard him say a couple of hundred yards down the road, I gave myself 50-50.
You get off talking to people about me behind my back going over my head.
What people?
What people would you think? I wasn't going to find out.
I don't even know what you're talking about, Nick.
No? You said I'm bringing heat on you? I got to listen to people because of your fucking shit? You're ordering me out? You better get your own fucking army, pal.
I didn't do anything. I mean, I didn't order you or anybody. I only told Andy Stone that you had a lot of heat on you and that was a problem.
You want me to get out of my own fucking town?
Yeah, I said let the bullshit blow over for a while so I can run the casino. Anything goes wrong with the casino, it's my ass. It's not yours, it's my ass.
I don't know whether you notice or not, but you only have your fucking casino because I made that possible. I'm what counts out here. Not your fucking country clubs or your fucking TV shows. And what the fuck are you doing on TV anyhow? You know, I get calls from back home every fucking day. They think you went batshit.
I'm only on TV because I gotta be able to hang around a casino. You understand that.
You
know that. Come on.
Ass. You could have had the food and beverage job without going on television. You wanted to go on TV.
Yeah, I did want to go on TV. That way I have a forum. I can fight back. I'm known. People see me. They know they can't fuck around with me like they could if I was an unknown. That's right.
You're making a big fucking spectacle of yourself.
Me? I wouldn't even be in this situation if it wasn't for you. You brought down so much fucking heat on me. I mean, every time I meet somebody here, the big question is, do I know you?
Oh, sure. And now you want to blame your fucking license on me.
No, Nicky, when you asked me if you could come out here, what did I tell you? I mean, you asked me, and I knew you were going to come out no matter what I said, but what did I tell you? Do you remember what I told you?
Back
do you
up,
remember
back
what
up
I told
fucking
you?
Minute here. 1 minute. I asked you, when the fuck did I ever ask you if I could come out here? Get this through your head,
you never...
Get this through your head, you Jew motherfucker, you. You only exist out here because of me. That's the only reason. Without me, you, personally, every fucking wise guy still around, I'll take a piece of your fucking Jew ass. Then where you gonna go? Your fucking warrant don't ever go over my fucking head again, you motherfucker, you.
Well, yeah.
No, I'll ask you. Yeah, yeah.
No, it was a gloss. You know, the glossy, the shot of the eyeglasses with the car, and the music again is a good example. The music thing. This was, I think, up to that point in time, a 3-hour film packed with music. I think it was the most expensive soundtrack ever up to that point, and including you heard that the instrumental piece on the car. That's Georges Delarue's music for Le Mépris. Contempt, Godard's film, which has to do with the themes of prostitution, cinema, all of this sort of thing. And we mixed it. We mixed it in with the drums of Ginger Baker on Cream at times. So we were starting to pull, why not use themes from other movies, you know? Which you do in Irish, too, you know?
Yeah.
But the gloss of Vegas, the whole thing, it was an extension, to a certain extent, extension of Goodfellas, only on a bigger scale.
Yeah.
And here, this scene, we always talked about this scene where the Joe's language is like a jazz riff. It's like music. It's like music, music, music. And then finally you've been warned, you know, and it leaves him there. His whole thing is the frozen look, trying to get a word in. And it's much harder in terms of, I'm not saying it's easy to do what Joe does, but very often a lot of people confuse really great acting with because they could see it. And when you think you're not seeing it, that's the big deal, you know, the look on the face, the eyes, and that's why some of the, you know, when a silent film is restored, and the style of acting, and not all of them, believe me, but in many of the great ones, you could see this extraordinary expression on the actors' faces. Lillian Gish, George, the one in Sunrise, that film, George O'Brien. I mean, amazing. So that, in a sense, it's really the internal. Everything's exploding in his head. What's he going to do? And also, it's beautiful because his character is his own self-destruction. He's got his own. At least Joe's character is a maniac in a sense. He's a psychopath. This guy is just like, he thinks he could pull everything together, and he won't give in. That great scene with you and the terrific actor L.Q. Jones. Where if you just said, I'd let that guy back in, but no, you know, no way. And it's his pride and the fall. And I think that one of the reasons Nick Pileggi got me involved in this story, and I had a deal at Universal, Tom Pollock and Casey Silver and those guys, you mm-hmm. know, and I had done Cape Fear with you.
Yeah.
And this for Universal. And in a sense, they were a lot to do with... the fact that it's not payback, but they were very good with me with Last Temptation of Christ. I had to reciprocate in those sense. And you brought me Cape Fear, which we did, I think, in 91. Mm. And then I went off and did Age of Innocence and came back to this. But this was a natural, I think, in the sense that it's a version of Paradise Lost. Here's this, God gives them this paradise of sin. Vegas, they could do anything, right? And they screw it up. They get cast out of the paradise, you know? They just, you know, it reminds me of the story Nick always tells of a guy in the old neighborhood who was a thief and a, you know, and he would go to church a lot, and he would pray to God to give him the strength to steal some more. Please, God. Because he's got to work. So where's the disconnect there? And that's what this is. That's what this is. And they blow it up completely. At the opening of the film, the car blows up. Because it's the issue, I always get into the thing about in Casino. I always felt that when you walk out in those clothes, I think it was a salmon-colored jacket or something, and the car blows up, it's like... it's the old story of how much is enough. With these guys, and all of us at this point, our society, I think, is never enough. And you're aiming towards, we're just on the road toward, and that's my feeling back in 95, was the explosion, you know, of cultural explosion. And it's reflected in this story, I think, because it has to do with our foibles and our pride. It just so happens they're gangsters and they're killers and, you know, some of them are killers, not all, and prostitutes and gamblers and, you know, as I said, paradise.
You want to go to silence?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oi. Come here. They were given sake, as the Roman soldier offered vinegar to the dying Christ. I prayed they remembered our Lord's suffering and took courage and comfort from it.
Well, I know as an actor, I wouldn't want to do that scene.
Oh, they were amazing. Yeah. That's Shinya Tsukamoto, who's a great avant-garde horror film filmmaker, the one who's yelling, the younger one. And the older one, Yossi, he's worked with Peter Brook for 40 years.
Wow.
He was 82 years old on that cross.
Wow.
82.
Wow.
The only thing he said to us that he wouldn't do is, I don't go in water. Meaning, don't expect me to get out. I said, no, fine. But they intended, it was the whole thing. They wanted to stay on the cross and keep doing it. I said, I couldn't. We were very concerned. But no, silence is religious issues always. Religion is the wrong word, I think. But because I spent so much time in St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, and part of that situation, my old friends, some of them were, street kids. Some were more interested in higher education and becoming real citizens of the world. In any event, Father Principe, who was a real diocesan priest, he was the one who made sense, actually. My parents were really great. It's just that they had to live in that world, and they had to maneuver. But this guy came in and he said, you don't have to live this way. He was about 22 or 23 years old, first diocese. He just passed away last year. And he gave us books. He gave us Dwight MacDonald's Memoirs of a Revolutionist. He gave us Graham Greene. Picked up James Joyce. He would play music. He told us to use your brains. Get out. He said, get out of here. Get out of here. You don't have to live. There's good people. He said, but you don't have to live in this style or in this cycle of getting married at 21, having children, moving, all this sort of thing. Take opportunity. Take the advantage of where you are in this life. Because we're bohemians. There was no reading. You know what I'm saying? It was a very different world. And so he made I wondered how he, as an ordained priest, dealt with the nature of human nature, and yet without succumbing to pride, without succumbing to any of the failures, the failings that so many can and do, unfortunately. But it's the nature of who we are as people. And so for me, I wondered, well, how is that translated into a world where people are like Mean Streets, or, whereas in the Asphalt Jungle, John Huston's film, a crime or that kind of thinking is described as a left-handed form of endeavor, of human endeavor. And in a way, because of many different reasons, sociological, even in some cases chemically, because they aren't, something is in their head, it isn't quite right, that's all they know, and they can't get out. And so you have Casino, the whole idea of the tragedy of every man and every woman's death. Is it a tragedy, or dealing with faith? Is it something that is a release? Is it something that transcends? And so for me, that faith that I was instilled with when I was a kid, that changes. You get older, but in the 60s. You go through the 60s, everything is open, there's all this stuff going on, you start to question everything. And ultimately, it's been a long kind of struggle, not finished, of course, but a struggle towards a mature faith, whatever that is. And this film, Silence, is one that it took me a long time to pull together. Jay Cox and I wrote the script based on the Endo, Shushiko Endo, his novel. And it took long because I didn't know how to write it. Based on the script. I didn't know where he was getting to. And finally, I think I got it. I'm not sure, but ultimately, it's about a struggle towards the very essence of faith, and not certainty, You know, right now, faith, I don't know, on a certain level, it's very surface, many, many, you know, and certainty, and has certainty as, let me put it this way, it's the kind of thing I was dealing with here, and even Kundun to a certain extent, and Last Temptation of Christ, of course, is not fashionable now. So, but it doesn't mean it isn't true, and doesn't mean we don't do it with conviction. It doesn't mean there isn't room for it. You know, we may wind up against a wall, who knows? But what is faith? What is, it was a Terry Malick wrote me a letter when he saw the picture. And he said, what does Christ want from us? Yeah, that's interesting. You know, not everybody believes in that, I understand, but it was a demand. And I saw it happen in the old neighborhood. I saw what some of the people doing terrible things, but they still had something in them, Bob, where they cared for each other. You know? It wasn't all, oh, sociopath and psychopath. It wasn't all that way. And so this film comes out of that. And also our new picture comes out of that. Irishman and I Heard You Paint Houses.
Yeah.
And it's right there. It's right there. And I think that's the one that ultimately states it, you know? That's the desire to, this is amazing to have been able to make this, to go to Taiwan and make this picture. It was a, you know, everybody sacrificed a lot. Yeah. No pay, nothing. It was wild. And the fact that it got released by a major studio is, you know, amazing. And the actors are wonderful, Garfield and Adam Driver. And the Japanese actors were terrific. So it was an experience, and it was a journey. Takes me on the, you know, that's why I went off in these different films, to try to combine the two and see where it really is. I think in Irish we get to a point.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so funny because it's a bit of trivia. Nobu Matsuhisa, my partner, he was always telling me, get Marty to look at Silence, try Silence. For years, I say, yeah, all right, I'll tell him. And I just, he kept bugging me about it, and finally you did it.
It's wild, yeah. Nobu was in, he made his screen debut in Casino. Remember he played Mr. Ichikawa, the whale, the big gambler, who won millions at the table, but still stole the washcloths and towels from the room.
Should we go?
This other guy? What do you?
Who?
This thing and Wolf?
Yeah, the thing. The thing.
You want to talk about that? Or?
Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah. You want to show that piece?
I guess so.
Yeah,
but
You didn't try to bribe this fucking FBI agent, did you?
No, I didn't try to bribe an FBI agent. You think I'm that fucking stupid? No.
What the fuck are you saying? I can't understand. Say that again.
I said, I'm gonna scare him with the FBI.
What the fuck are you saying?
I said.
Are you fucking high?
I can't him with the FBI.
Jordan! Are you fucking high? Jordan, do me a favor. Stay where you are. Don't get behind the wheel of the car. I'm gonna send another woman to pick you up. Jordan!
After 15 years in storage, the Lemons had developed a delayed fuse. It took 90 minutes for these little fuckers to kick in, but once they did, pow. I mean, I had skipped the tingle phase and went straight to the drool phase.
Tell me where you are.
These little bastards were so strong, I discovered a whole new phase, the cerebral palsy phase. Come on, stand up. Okay, walking's out. All right, think, what else is there? Yes, I can crawl. I can crawl like Skylar.
Those were strong in those days.
Yeah,
in our time.
They were.
And he had six? Is that
right? Yeah. A delayed reaction. Boy. You know, they were so silly. They were like, oh, this is ridiculous. It's never going to end. And boy, does it hit. But, you know, the whole thing with you, 20 some odd years ago, gave me a call And you were doing a film, This Boy's Life. And you said that this kid, Leo DiCaprio, is really good. You got to work with him sometime. And you don't usually say that, you know.
Yeah. Well, we had a reading with Leo for This Boy's Life. Well, Leo was there, and another kid was reading for the part that Leo eventually played. And I told Art Linson, the producer, I said, he's really good, this kid. And so they switched it around eventually, and Leo did play that part. It was only just a reading. I don't think it was a commitment to any of the actors, I don't think. But Leo, they used as they should have. He was terrific. And that's it.
That's it.
So, Leo, are you out here?
Leo, come on, where are you? He's hiding. But he, what? I heard something. Leo? Leo. He's here, believe me. There he is. I can't see. Now, the funny thing is, years later, Mike Ovitz comes into the picture, again, changing my life a number of times. Mike, the most extraordinary thing, he's got Last Temptation of Christ made, he got Age of Innocence made, and he put me together with Leo, and it became Gangs of New York, this passion project I'd had for so many years. And this kid, that was 1999, 2000. And but Leo, it's like an extraordinary fortune because he liked the pictures we made. And he wanted to make films like that in a way. In other words, not being afraid of certain topics he was more concerned with the truth of a character and of a situation. And he wasn't afraid to go anywhere with the stuff. And so, you know, it's been an extraordinary thing. And he convinced me to make Wolf by the time we did make it, Wolf of Wall Street. I was supposed to make Silence, but then we changed it again. But it's been an extraordinary five pictures, is it? Five, yeah, five pictures over the years. And Wolf was the one. Wolf was the one we were talking, you mentioned about Bernie, right? Made of.
Bernie, yeah, yeah. What did I say? Well, you make a movie about Jordan Belfort, which is the part Leo played, the character, instead of one of the more well-known Bernie Madoff. What's there about these characters like Johnny Boy and Tommy DeVito that attracts you?
Is that it?
That's it. Well, yeah. Your dramas often have strong, even hysterical, comedic scenes. How do you get away with it? Wolf has, and I hesitate to say, the sort of happy ending. How did you let that happen?
Oh, wow. I thought the first happy ending I did was Last Temptation of Christ because he goes back on the cross. he accepts being the Messiah. You know, that was the first happy ending, but people didn't see it that way. Many didn't. But no, in this case, I mean, the thing with these characters is that every man, nickel and diming, struggling to, it's a microcosm again, reflecting the macrocosm. And in a case of like a Madoff, he's the aristocracy of the confidence man. He hits the bigger targets and he takes advantage of these people and does what a horrible stuff. But Jordan is in this character that in the film, you know, he's the confidence man for us. He is the one to take advantage of all of us and sell you something we don't need and take our money and never give it back and don't really necessarily pay a social debt, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But in any event, it's the thinking. It's the thinking of, as I say, I don't know about the actual Jordan I'm talking about, the one that was created in the film. It's a way of a savage kind of rampant trade, so to speak. Not fair trade, but how they can take advantage of what's part of our nature that we tend to take advantage of each other. In fact, there was one quote somewhere in the picture, I'm not sure if it's in there, where he says, you know, use these techniques on not everyone, he said, but use it on the people that should be used upon. But why should it be? If a person is naive, why take advantage of them? See, but if you look at our thinking in terms of American thinking, in terms of trade, in terms of, you know, yes, we have to protect the country. Yes, we have to, prosper, so to speak. But unchecked, it's Wolf of Wall Street, you know. And I believe one of the people in the cabinet recently said that the film misrepresented the financial world. Yeah, you know, which hour? It's the same. It's power and money and the confidence man. Very American, very, very interesting. Melville's last novel is called The Confidence Man, 1860 or something. I forget the, and it's a pretty tough one. It's a pretty interesting novel, but it deals with the great confidence men, the snake oil salesmen, all that sort of thing, which is very American, you know. The land of opportunity. And so when opportunity is unchecked that way, it's disaster for all in that sense. Thank you.
The Tribeca Film Festival takes place every year in New York City. To learn more about all of our programs, head to TribecaFilms.com.